Hello, everyone. My name is Jacob Minnig. I'm the host of the Behavior Health Integration Podcast. Today, we have a very special guest. Her name is Kristen Terry. She is a licensed mental social worker from the state of Texas. We will begin discussions on therapist self-care, how we can advocate for one another, what does the term burnout actually mean as a therapist, and different ways we can all help the mental health system as a whole. We are all in for a special treat, and without further ado, let's get started. Kristen, thank you so much for being on the show today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm super excited to talk to you, Jacob. Thanks for having me.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself? What really motivates you to get into the field, just to start off, like the mental health in general?
Yeah. So I have been a licensed master social worker since 2011. And I guess, you know, that's always an interesting question. There's so many different avenues I could take to answer that. But I think that we all have a story, right? Like, I believe that like social workers and mental health professionals were born. We don't necessarily choose this.
Yep.
It's usually like our upbringing or life experience that kind of leads us to this field, right? And so, I didn't know it at the time. And then throughout my time in social work, I realized kind of like my underlying motivations for being drawn to this field just because of the experiences I've had in my life. But I think the biggest thing, and it's the most cliche thing to say, but like, I can't think of any other way to say it than I just wanted to make a difference. I wanted to help people. I love people. So I got into social work with the idea that originally it was to be a therapist, and then I learned about community administration practice, which is more of like the macro aspect. So, you know, building programs, evaluating programs, things like that, making an impact on a wider scale. And so that was my concentration in my master's program. I didn't end up fully working in that capacity. I mainly did clinical work, but I also worked for schools of social work as both adjunct professor and a field advisor. So I helped the students get placed in their required internship. So I've kind of had my hands in a lot of different places, but mostly working with teens and within education.
So just curious, what was your favorite part of being a professor then?
Yeah, I think for me personally, I love being able to be creative and to come up with different ways to present the material. So I was really passionate about that. I do have one particular experience that I don't know why it was so impactful to me, but I was teaching an undergraduate class at a local university. And it was kind of the like foundational theory class that all social workers have to take. And we were talking about spirituality, which is usually like a big no-no. We don't talk about it. Like, we just really don't know how to talk about it. So I wanted to come up with a way to creatively present this in like a non-threatening way. So I actually put together a panel of people representing different faiths. So I had like Jews, Muslims, Sikhs, Mormons, atheists, Buddhists, Baha'i. I had like it was like a 10 or 15 member panel. And so the students were able to ask questions to them and then kind of get like an insight, like, okay, if you were working with a client that was a member of the Sikh faith, for example, like what are some things that you might want to keep in mind? So just being able to be creative and then like showing the students like different ways to engage with the material and just really getting those foundational theories down and seeing how it could impact not only their like clinical career, but also like just them as a human, right? Because a lot of things that we learn in our profession is just like how to be a good human, like how to communicate, how to be an active listener. Like, these are life skills. And so I really loved seeing the students, you know, their eyes kind of light up when they like, when things clicked, you know?
No, I think that's a great idea to do that panel, and it gives them almost like real life experience on, okay, how do you get around particular issues that you may not be fully aware of about a culture? And this is how you present yourself. This is how you ask questions. And I think that's an awesome idea.
Yeah, I know. It was a lot of fun. We got a really, really good feedback. And I also did that for our segment on culture. So I invited people from different cultural backgrounds to kind of get a little bit of insight because like, at the end of the day, like, you can read a textbook all day long and there's, there's, you know, there's value in it. And we also need to hear from the people with lived experience. You know, there's only so much you can learn about like theories and perspectives. Like, you've got to get in front of people with that lived experience. I mean, that's almost, to me, it's almost more valuable than any kind of, like, you know, scholarly research.
You know, it's kind of funny. Do you sometimes just would tell your students that it's like, hey, you know, this classroom stuff is great, you guys, but this has nothing to do in the real world. Like, you're going to have different experiences. You're going to feel differently because you're going to be out there with people rather than the classroom.
Oh yeah. I mean, cause that was the biggest thing that I learned is that, you know, you hone these skills and there's value in it. I don't want to like discredit the value and like doing role plays and stuff. It gives you a really nice foundation, but at the end of the day, like when you're in front of a real human being,
yeah,
like sometimes you have to throw things out the window and just like be in the moment with what works, especially, you know, my experience in working with teens and preteens, like you have to shift within a session really quickly. Mm-hmm. Like I was working with a girl that was kind of had some like phobias and maybe a little bit of like OCD tendencies. And I just was having a hard time reaching her, but I know that she really liked Taylor Swift. And so yes. During the session, in order just to like to build rapport, we would just like stop and have a dance party to her favorite Taylor Swift song. And that's like, that's something you can't teach. There's no theory behind it. It's just like, it's checking in with your clinical intuition.
It's like being a human being though, too, and knowing where she's at in life.
Yeah. Like, hey, I'm just trying to connect with you as a human being. Like I'm mm-hmm. not, yes, I am a professional and I have mm-hmm. these fancy letters behind my name, but I'm also like a human and I want to like connect with you on a human level.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You know, and I want to ask you something too about the real life experience. I don't know about you, but the biggest thing that helped me the most pass my LADC exam is actually working as an LADC. Because again, you learn so much about even the process of therapy, the intake process, how to do particular groups. Was that similar to you in your experience with the licensing exam?
I just want to make sure I understand correctly. So like you found more value in actually just like diving into the work. Yeah, absolutely. Like, I mean, in social work, we have 2 required internships before we're able to take the licensing exam. So we can technically sit for the licensing exam like 6 weeks before we technically graduate. Wow. So I chose to do that so everything would be like fresh on my mind. But oh yeah, hands down. Like, I mean, that's where theory meets practice. Again, it's like you learn theory all day long.
You're quote unquote supposed to buy a bunch of books, study materials, and technically you're supposed to.
Yeah, I didn't buy anything. I found like a free
thing
online. I know some people like, and I just happen to be like a decent test taker. I know there's a lot of like injustice that's coming out now, especially about the social work exam, that it's racially biased. Like there's a very large percentage of African-American students who are not, they're having very low pass rates. And so anyway, that's a whole tangent, but like, so they're looking into that, like, yeah, testing is very limited in so many ways, and it's made for, you know, middle class. It's made by middle class white people for middle class white people, and it's like that's a huge, you know, injustice. So they're looking into that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, moving forward, so you're in the field, you're working as a professor, a teacher. Did you eventually get into crisis work then?
Yeah, so I mainly did, so like my first job out of grad school was working as a school social worker in the school system here in Texas. And then I went to teach, and then I got back into clinical work, and then I was teaching again. So I was kind of like back and forth, and sometimes I would like teach a class while I was doing like crisis work. But my last clinical position was in a suicide prevention program for teens. Yeah, so it was an intensive outpatient program. So they had either stepped down directly from inpatient care, or they were stepping up from their outpatient care. So they had just either attempted or were having like increased ideation. There's certain criteria they had to meet to be a good fit for our program, because it's super intensive, like 10 hours a week of therapy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can you, again, elaborate a little bit more? So it was a treatment center, but was it more of like a mental health-based treatment center, or was there some substance abuse too added in that?
So it was actually a children's hospital that has the suicide prevention program. It's actually one of the very few in the nation. And it's, yeah, very clinically backed by evidence-based practices. So we also have a separate IOP for substance abuse. So sometimes we would have like the co-occurring kiddos, but a lot of what we found was that they needed to go address their substance abuse issues first before coming to us. You know, so we would definitely work with the other program and usually refer them like, all right, like, yeah, you're having suicidal thoughts, but really your biggest problem right now that you're facing is substance abuse. So let's refer you there.
You know, it's funny how different states, and I don't even know if this is a state thing, like when it comes to their views on philosophies and therapy and co-occurring, where my university is always taught to treat them both in the same, like where you would never just treat the substance abuse first, then the mental health, or the mental health first, then substance abuse. You collaborate them together to treat both. So I found that very interesting that not you in it, per se, but your hospital was just like administrators like, well, we need to treat the substance abuse first. Well, in my opinion, how can you do that when there could also be a huge correlation with mental health that is attributing that substance abuse?
Yeah. And I think like they're definitely cognizant of that. I think that any substance abuse center, like they realize that it's not just chemical dependency. It's like the why behind the substance abuse. So they definitely like integrated it within that program, but there's a definite focus on substance abuse. But I get what you're saying. Like we can't just like compartmentalize issues, but it was, that's kind of how it was treated. Like, all right, we deal with suicide prevention, you guys deal with substance abuse. Yeah. And it was just like, they couldn't do both programs at the same time because they were both IOPs.
Well, I have a lot of theories on that too, especially Minnesota. And I think we're not the only state, but there's a lot of ego involved with the two fields where, hands down, we still have a lot of facilities that in Minnesota that are strongly chemical abuse, no mental health. It's all about the 12 steps. And like, we don't want anything to do with mental health. And mental health is the same way where it's like, we're superior, we're better. So that's something we're struggling with too, big time over here, is how can we combine together? And again, it's just those darn egos.
Yeah, we definitely need to there's a lot of ego, surprisingly, in but yeah, I get what you're saying, but luckily that wasn't my experience. It was more just like, I don't know, I really loved the hospital I worked with. I mean, we really had like some cutting edge programs that I think were, you know, really making a huge difference in the lives of teens.
So were you doing most of your work in person with these teens then? Or was it on the phone too at times?
No, it was always in person. This was before the pandemic. So they go to two group therapy sessions a week that are 3 hours long each. They meet with an individual therapist. They have a 3-hour, what we call multi-family groups, and multiple families from within the program to learn skills on communication. So it was all definitely in person. I did not experience what happened during COVID. I have no idea how they continued to do that. I mean, I think that would be super challenging. And now you're seeing mental health companies that are trying to offer IOPs from home. And I think that's very interesting. And I haven't delved much into it, but I'll see an ad that'll come across LinkedIn. And I'm like, I don't really know how I feel about that. I really just don't know. Like an IOP online, like, oh gosh. Like there's something to be said about human connection in person. And that's part of the magic behind group therapy. Yes. The group therapy is often more effective than individual therapy because they're getting to connect with folks that are in similar experiences. And I think a lot of that, I'd be curious to see outcomes, you know, online versus in person. I don't know if it has that same magic online. I really don't.
It's so funny you say that, but like, I'm with you. I gotta do in person. I worked with this one facility a couple of years ago, and this is like right when the pandemic occurred, and they were introducing like group therapy online as well as like in person. So obviously I was an in-person counselor, and like I had a good relationship with the online counselor because, you know, we'd all meet in the same facility. So I talked to him, I'm like, man, how do you do it or whatever? And I swear to you, he absolutely loved it. He's like, I think online therapy or group therapy is the best thing ever.
Wow.
We can get like 16 people in the computer, you know, with their little squares. And
yeah. And
I'm like, God bless you, man, because I couldn't do that. I can't. I got to be with the people in person and experience with them. I have to have experiences in the moment with them that I feel is very special. Again, not just for the client, but for myself as well.
And yeah, no, definitely. I think it maybe just all boils down to like personal preference. You know, maybe some people are okay with online and they can get the same amount of benefits, but like, I'm very much like you, like I have to be in person. Like even when I was seeing my personal therapist, she would offer, you know, online sessions. I'm like, no, like I will drive the 30 minutes to be in your presence, because that's the therapeutic alliance is the highest indicator of success in therapy. And I just don't know, for me, like, I just don't know if that can happen via Zoom for me. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
So back when you were working with the teenagers and everything and the families, what did you find to be like the biggest issue? And I know that's kind of a hard question because there's a lot of different situations that could happen. But especially with the teens and families, what do you think was the biggest concerns with the majority of the families that you work with?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, the first word that came to my mind was communication. So our program was very, very heavy on communication, how to communicate their feelings in a safe way and teaching parents to respond in appropriate ways, right? So I did a lot of coaching with parents like, all right, you know, we're working with your team to be comfortable with telling you when they're having strong suicidal ideation or urges to self-harm. And what's going to be most important to you, mom and dad, or whoever caregiver, is that when they tell you, it's going to be really hard, but you're going to have to respond calmly.
Yeah.
Do not freak out. That will do all kinds of other things, unintended consequences. So it was a lot of coaching and training them. And we did use the numbering system. So rating intensity of feelings on a scale of 1 to 10. And so making check-ins very easy and less dramatic. So like, hey, where are you at today? All right, I'm a 7. And so we would have them fill out this kind of like thermometer of feelings to know, okay, what does a 7 mean for this child and what do they need in that moment? So learning to ask for what they need is huge.
Can I also ask you something? Do you feel like another issue parents have with their teens is maybe the parent does not want to believe that their kid or their child is struggling?
Oh yeah. I mean, denial was a huge thing. Like that meme of the cartoon dog where there's like fire, like basically his house is on fire and he's like, this is fine. Like, that's what it reminds me of. Like, they're just pretending like everything is fine, but like, no, your house is on fire. Yeah. Things are clearly not fine. And so a lot of parents would like discount their teen's feelings and like, you know, back in my day, like we just had to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps. Yep. That's a big thing here in Texas. Like it is a whole another world here. Mm-hmm. We are like decades behind in mental health because we have this Southern mentality of pull yourself up by your own bootstraps. Yeah. It's getting better, but yeah, there was definitely like a generational thing there where it's like these parents are coming from a generation when you don't talk about feelings.
You don't talk about it.
And we're telling them literally for 10 hours a week, talk about your feelings.
Yep.
It will make things better. And so it was a huge learning curve for both. Yeah, parents and teens.
Well, and that's why I try to explain to my adult clients is that as human beings, if you want to believe in a spiritual concept or whatnot, like we were given these emotions and feelings for a reason. We have them. Mm-hmm. So why not express them and use them?
Yeah. And learn healthy ways to express them and learn how to harness your emotions and not let them control you. I mean, yeah, it definitely does serve a purpose. You know, they're motivating us to action. We feel fear because we need to act, you know, when we were being chased down by saber-toothed tigers in prehistoric times, like if we didn't feel fear, if we instead felt curiosity, oh, what does this kitty cat want? Like, no, it's not a kitty cat. It's a saber-toothed tiger. You need to run or you're going to get eaten, you know?
Well, and getting back to the whole communication aspect and everything, there was this situation. It was like my third year in college or whatever. I was going to community college, and I had this female classmate who was dealing with some mental health issues. And you know, some classmates have numbers. We communicate through homework and stuff. And again, I didn't judge her for this, but she's telling me about all these negative feelings she's having, and that she not necessarily was suicidal, but she's cutting herself. And as a student, I'm like, I didn't really know what to, like, all I could do, because again, I wasn't a therapist at that time, was like be supportive. But I'm like, maybe you should get help. Maybe you should see a doctor or a therapist. But she keeps telling me she's continuing cutting herself. And again, I'm just a classmate. You know what I mean? I'm just giving her advice on, like, you know, what I would tell a friend, like, you know, try to get some help. But she's like, you know, my parents don't believe me. My mom gets upset with me, tells me I'm lying. And then eventually she got help, only though because the mom opened the door and saw her with a knife in her wrist, bloodied up.
Yikes.
Then, only then did she get help. And again, she's doing better now, but that was again just a very sad story about that. Again, lack of communication, lack of believing that your child is struggling.
Yeah, definitely. And unfortunately, like, we can't force people to get help if they're not ready to do it. And it's also important to know our role. Like, I think that's another part of like having balance in the mental health profession is knowing when to like turn it off. Like, okay, you said it yourself, like my role is your classmate. Like, I am not your therapist. And I think that's something I had to learn, you know, the hard way. Like, I was trying to be everyone's therapist. And I was like, no, like they don't want a therapist. Like, they want a friend. And just like, that's all you can say sometimes. It's like, hey, I don't know. I'm happy to connect you with some resources if you need help. Sorry you're going through this. Like, that's all you can do. Can't be their therapist.
Absolutely. No, and it was weird. Like when I was at tech at a treatment center too, and this is cool because I would like to know what you would do, like if you were one of the counselors in the situation where I envy counselors who work at adolescent treatment center, because it's just so sad sometimes when we see a teenager struggling, and then when the parents come in for family time and there's a lot of chaos, like let's say in that session. And like again, the parents themselves are not in a good place, yet you have to send that teenager back there when they graduate. And a lot of the times, the dang parents are cooking a meth lab in the basement at the home where the teenager's going back. And I mean, I don't know what you do in that situation. And maybe I don't know if you had similar situations where it's like this kid's going back in a bad situation. Maybe it's not Hill, maybe it's the parents.
Yeah, I mean, these things don't happen in isolation. Like, we're a product of our environment, right? And so I think that was the most challenging piece of the work and working with teens and children is that you can only do so much. Like, the family is a system. Like, what one part does affects the others. That's basic systems theory, you know, it's just inevitable. So who is the client here? It's not just the teen. You can teach the teen coping skills all day long. And I felt like that's a lot of what I was doing, was just saying, like, man, like, it really sucks that you're in this family situation. I'm so sorry. I can't do anything about it. And what you can do about it is you can learn these skills, you know, and if your parents choose to use them, that's great. But yeah, that was a really hard piece. Not being able to do anything, right? It's really tough. That's the hardest part. Like, that's why I think a lot of people prefer working with adults, is because at least you're just working with adults. You're not having to work with like dysfunctional parents too.
Exactly, you know, and that's right. Like at some point you have to let go of control and hope for the best for the teenager. I'm like, maybe, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, it's just like hopefully they'll get out of that family system if it's not working, and down the line it'll just work out. But what else can you do, right?
Yeah, and the cool thing is that you hear about these stories all the time. You hear about people who leave home when they're 17, 18, and they go on to have like really successful lives. And so I think the biggest thing we can do in working with teens is teaching them resiliency. You know, you don't have control over your life situation. I'm so sorry. But you have so much control over how you choose to react, how you choose to use coping skills. And I mean, sometimes they would roll their eyes on coping skills, but it's really like, it's not just coping, we're teaching you resiliency. What do you do when life really sucks and there's nothing you can do about it, but just get through it? How are we going to get you through this? I remember having this conversation with several teens. Okay, let's just get you to 18. We just need to get you to 18. And I swear you can go and live your own life and, you know, be a successful person. And then you get to choose on your terms what kind of relationship you want to have with your family. You have no obligation to them. You know, thank you so much, parents, for birthing me into this world, but I don't have to stay in contact with you if you're a toxic family or toxic person. Boundaries.
Yes. Well, that's exactly what I was going to talk about too, because at the treatment center I work at, a lot of the biggest issues I have with my clients is just boundaries. And some clients, it's so hard for them to even understand that concept, because their boundaries, especially when it comes to sexual abuse, trauma, their boundaries were violated numerous times throughout their life through, let's say, the ages of 4 through 16. So they don't understand boundaries. And I'm like, you could tell the person to stop. You could say no. You know, as an adult, I'm trying to teach them the skills, but they cannot comprehend it, because their mindset is just change your mindset about the abuse that's happening to you and it'll be better. Where again, I'm trying to say, well, no, you don't have to. Again, there's a thought on acceptance, but it's like, you could tell that perpetrator to stop, or if they're disrespecting you, be like, please don't talk that way to me. I don't appreciate it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think that's a huge light bulb that goes off for a lot of people, is that I get to choose. I teach people the behavior I will tolerate. Mm-hmm. We do. We every day when we're interacting with people, we're teaching them what we're going to tolerate and what we're not, and that we actually have a choice in it. So just like what you said, what you said just made me really uncomfortable. Like, please don't say that anymore. Like, they literally, people who grow or who experience trauma and abuse, they don't know that they can do that, because they've always just had to deal with it because there was no way out, because unfortunately, maybe the abuser was like the parent or the family member. They don't realize they have a choice, but you do. Every day you have a choice. And I'm just learning, like, even in my mid 30s and adulthood, like, I'm learning about boundaries every day. And it's hard because of my background too. It's hard because you feel mean for doing it. And it's like, no, boundaries are not mean. It's kind. It's kind to you.
Respecting yourself.
Yes.
No, and I just had to look up this quote too. It's on LinkedIn that I found out, and it's so inspirational to me. I'll read it to you right now. It is, as a therapist, I'm not interested in helping people learn coping skills so they could be better. As a therapist, I'm not interested in helping people learn coping skills so they can better tolerate being mistreated.
Right.
Love it.
And that's true. And yet at the same time with teens, that's what I felt like I kind of had to do. I had to teach them how to deal with being mistreated and stand up for themselves. But like, there's a whole, like, it's different. There's a power differential when it comes to parent child, but yes, in adulthood, I do agree with that quote. But and when childhood, I feel like it's not.
Well,
I'll
say there's one thing you could do. I don't know what it's like in the state of Texas. Minnesota is really bad. Is obviously you can contact CPS, of Child Protection Services.
Oh yeah, no, definitely.
But I don't know about Texas. In the state of Minnesota, it is, let's say, very difficult. The child needs to be in a really, really, really bad situation, really, really bad environment for CPS to take any action.
Yeah, no, it's true. The system is very broken. They're very overworked, underpaid. There's a high burnout rate. Like, they just, they simply can't respond to every inquiry. So yeah, it's pretty much like you have to have a kid in a basement in a cage for them to, like, I know that sounds horrible, but like, I'm not joking. Like, it has to be, well, like, active. If it's active physical abuse, active sexual abuse, yes, hands down, they will be there. But if it's anything that's not quite there yet, it gets a little sticky. And even when they do go investigate, you know, it's like the best case scenario always is that they can work it out within the family. You know, it's So it's, I don't know, CPS workers get a bad rap, but they have got a hard job and they're extremely under-resourced, yeah. underpaid, overworked. It's just, it's a recipe for disaster. And in Texas, a few years ago, they actually, they were so hard up for CPS workers, basically, that they lowered the requirements. And so they only have to have, I believe, a 2-year degree, or maybe it's even like a high school diploma. Like, so literally CPS will just like, cause they put you through their own school. That's like, I mean, it sounds like it's pretty rigorous, but it's like 12 weeks. And it's like, they're now accepting that in lieu of actual formal education, which is just so scary on so many different levels, but it's like, that's what they've had to do. I get why they did it, because they're desperate. They want to recruit people, and like people with degrees, you know, aren't having it, I guess. So.
And I understand another viewpoint. No, and I understand another viewpoint too. This is from working as an arms worker, working with kids like 5-6-year-olds and everything. And I would talk to a CPS worker about what would it take, you know, in this type of environment for this kid to be taken out. They said there needs to be at least 1.5 feet of trash everywhere in the apartment, so it's difficult to get to places like the bathroom, the kitchen. And I'm like, my God. Oh, well, I guess they're okay, fine. Like, I there was not 1.5 feet of trash in the apartment everywhere. I will say that. Okay. But from another point of view, it's just like, because there's so many kids out there living on the streets that are going hungry, that those kids, you know, need to get taken care of first.
Yeah. Well, and the thing is, if a child is removed, where are you going to put them? There's a shortage of foster parents. There's a shortage of group homes. So some of it is like purely logistical. Like, yes, this child probably does need to be removed, but we don't have anywhere for you to go. You know, it's oh my gosh, like it's a horribly broken system that needs so much help. And I don't know what the answers are. I really don't.
Yeah. And I think that's something where I personally need to work on empathy towards the system, because a lot of, like you just said, I don't take into consideration where it's like I'm watching a TV show or I'm watching a situation with a farm. I'm like, oh, that's horrible. Like, this is happening to that kid, that. Oh, well, that should just be fixed. Not taking into account, okay, well, there's steps that need to be taken. And then, like you said, where are they going to find another place for that child? It's not as easy as snapping your fingers.
Yeah, it's not. There's so many moving pieces, and you know, and there's like legal repercussions. You know, you hear about people like suing CPS for taking their children. So now they're having to probably be a little like more guarded. And it's just, yeah, there's so many factors that we don't see. And that's why it takes kind of like this holistic perspective to see like, yes, the system seems very broken and evil, but there's also a reason that it is. And like, let's look at the gaps and let's look and see where it's broken and see if we can like brainstorm solutions, you know, from every angle.
Absolutely. And no, it's funny, it kind of reminds me of just the whole behavior health, mental health system in itself.
Yeah,
it's right. Broken.
It is. And it's, I have a lot to say there. And I see like tech companies coming in and seeing an opportunity. And I want to believe that there are some that are like doing this out of the goodness of their hearts. Like I know one in particular, he was motivated by his own experience of trying to find treatment for his child and getting that personal experience with the broken mental health system. So he wanted to build something better, which is great. And yet it turns into a business because you have investors involved that want to see a return on their investment. So then they're getting pressure from their investors to increase their revenue, which ends up, you know, being, you know, therapists taking on very high caseloads and maybe not providing as good care. So it's like, oh man, it's like, even when people try to like step in and like disrupt the pattern is what they call it. Mm-hmm. Like they're trying to be a pattern disruptor within the mental health system, but then it just like creates this whole other slew of issues. Like I don't want to like name drop, but I mean it's public knowledge, so BetterHelp is actually being investigated because they are seeing the transcripts of therapy sessions. So they've been all de-identified, so there's no personal information within them, but they're using the content of people's sessions to basically sell to like companies like Facebook and other marketing companies to know what wording to use to basically advertise mental health services. So they're literally trying to like poke at people's like trauma points.
Yeah.
To motivate them for therapy, which is like, well, I'm glad like people do need therapy, and sometimes people mm-hmm. don't know that they need it. And so it's like, oh my gosh, there's like so many ethical issues that come up when you try to solve something, you end up just creating like 50 more problems. So it's like, I don't even know, you know, yeah. I'm glad that people are doing something. But I think the biggest thing, and I'm involved in a lot of conversations on LinkedIn about this mm-hmm. is that you have to, if you're dealing with mental health, you have to have mental health professionals and clinicians at the C level, at the executive level, making big decisions, because they are going to be the company's conscience, their ethical guidepost, because that person is licensed to uphold these ethics. And so if you just have a bunch of business people making decisions about mental health services, it's just like, it becomes a very wacky world.
Mm-hmm.
And we're seeing it happen. We're seeing these companies come under investigation because they're not including the very professionals. Like literally, we are the product. Like they are selling therapy, exactly. Yet they're not including therapists in the decision-making process.
Mm-hmm. Well, it also reminds me a lot when it comes to like a business system too. Just like here in Minnesota, where we would have like these treatment owners and CEOs, and they're building this company and they're building this treatment center, but they yet have no therapy experience themselves. They don't, it's more just like their MBAs or yes. their, they have a very high knowledge of business, and which is great. Mm-hmm. So they do these treatment centers, yet like they just pile on the clients after clients after clients on like social workers, LPCCs, LADCs. And they just, the therapist can't take it anymore. Like sometimes they'll have a caseload of 20 or more and they get burnt out. It's a money grab. Let's just call it how it is. It is a money grab. And I just feel like a lot of the owners do not give a shit mm-hmm. about a high caseload, because they don't understand the stress that these counselors are under. It's yeah. all about the money. And it's a lot of money. I looked into it, especially with like the insurance contracts and what they
for
get
sure.
for clients. Not even for the therapy sessions, but for just sleeping in bed at night is a lot of money.
It is. It's a ridiculous amount of money. And it's true. And the thing is, like, it doesn't have to be one or the other. We need people with MBAs, because therapists usually aren't very like business savvy, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like you see a lot of these nonprofits that, you know, helping professionals set up, and it's like they don't do well because like they have no idea about business. Mm-hmm. And they're like, I don't know, how do we do this? So like if you can pair together and be on the same page, and again, we're kind of like that, the angel on their shoulder, like, don't do that. This isn't gonna be good for business. Like what is good for your employees is good for business.
Mm-hmm.
So they're thinking that the way to drive more revenue is by more patients. Let's yep. get those button beds. But what happens when you do this to the point of burnout? How much does it cost? This is costing the company's money, because to hire somebody, mm-hmm. just to hire one person, it's a ridiculous amount. I don't want to quote it, but I want to say it's something like $80,000 just to hire a new person, just like the onboarding process.
Yep.
And so it's within these companies' best interest to keep the employees that they have. And they don't realize that the way you do this is by listening to them, maybe decreasing caseloads, and you're actually going to save money.
Right.
Yeah. Because right. you're not having to hire people all the time, and they're giving better quality care. And so these patients are actually seeing the improvement, right? And investors are going to want to invest more because they have a high, you know, clinical improvement rate.
And I also like using the theory on, okay, if you take client in and you just sense that they're not a good fit, well, sometimes, like, again, maybe it's not always the owner, maybe it's the treatment director or the manager is like, well, we're going to take this client anyways. I think we could work with them, when in reality, they should be somewhere else. So you take in a lot of those type of clients, mm-hmm. and chaos happens and they leave relatively quick, like within a week. And okay, if you want to think business, well, you're losing money that way rather than taking fewer clients, but who are right for your program.
Yeah.
And they're going to last longer, and it's going to increase the chances of them graduating Which, I mean, again, I'm not a math expert, but I feel like you'd be making a lot more money that way.
Yeah, definitely. No, I agree. And that's why, again, that we need a clinical voice within leadership. And unfortunately, what I've noticed is that these companies tend to just kind of put us in a box and like, this is all you're capable of. Like, you went to school for this. Like, why don't you just stay there working with the clients and let us handle the business? Mm-hmm. But there's actually clinicians like me. I want to be a part of it. Like, I don't want to do one-on-one work anymore. What I've always wanted to do is to be at the leadership level. Okay. So there's clinicians that are not only wanting to do this, but they're trained to do this. And mm-hmm. just big business doesn't know this. And so that's part of what I'm trying to do on LinkedIn, is trying to be a voice and saying, hey, we are more than therapists. Mm-hmm. We are more than this. Like, there's so much we can offer to your company. Please see the value, because you're missing out. You really are. And then your business is going to suffer as a result. And it's coming to pass, you know, mm-hmm. And more companies are going to be in the headlines. And it's very sad, because it's impacting lives.
So what would you say to the therapist now? Would you say like, they should go back to college and get MBAs, or do you feel like they should just study up on business management more to be more aware and understanding of these issues and how they can improve them?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, the thing is, like, if you are called and you feel like really called to do therapy, then you should be able to do that. But for the folks like me who do have like a kind of a business background and have that mm-hmm. interest, I would encourage you to do it. And not necessarily that you have to get an MBA, but there's so many like courses and ways to upskill without getting a degree, right? So there's mm-hmm. things you can learn, but we just have to be given the opportunity for that and to ask for the opportunities.
Okay. So are there any other ways, do you feel like we as a profession can advocate for ourselves too? Like, another avenues?
Yeah. This has been on my mind a lot, about like, you know, who helps the helpers, and, you know, why is it that we're so good at advocating for others, but not necessarily for ourselves? And I think the biggest thing is just kind of like speaking out, you know, like, I'm seeing more people, more mental health professionals on LinkedIn speaking out, and it's getting the attention of big business. But if we don't tell them, they don't know. We can't expect them. I think for a while I was frustrated, like, why can't they see this clearly? Like, I would be a good fit. It's like, okay, I can remain frustrated, or I can like speak out and show them. So sometimes you just need to step up to the plate and show them. So maybe it's writing about, you know, all these transferable skills. So that's kind of where my mind is at right now, just like advocating in whatever avenue. Mine happens to be like LinkedIn right now, mm-hmm. and it's growing in power, and it's exciting to see, and I'm connecting with really cool people like you, and I've made a lot of other really good connections, and we're building our own community, and I think it's really important to have that solidarity, because we can't do it alone. We can't change the system on our own. We have to do this together. One voice, it's just like a whisper, but like, if all of us are speaking up, like, it's going to be loud and it's going to be deafening. So they have no choice but to listen to us.
Oh yeah. I think LinkedIn is awesome for marketing. And like you said, coordinating with one another. Again, I'll use too, like Facebook, Instagram, obviously there's Twitter and all that.
Sure. But like where the professionals hang out is LinkedIn. Like, I feel mm-hmm. I'm very biased, because I'm literally not on any other social media platform, but like, LinkedIn is where people come to talk about business, right? They kind of like their business hats on, whereas like Instagram, I know like business is kind of sprinkled there, but it's a little bit of everything. But LinkedIn, mm-hmm. and I know it's diversifying, but like LinkedIn, I view it as like a professional thing mm-hmm. that's becoming more, you know, it's becoming more than just professionals, but like, I think people come there for the purpose of networking and learning more professionally.
Yeah. And Facebook's getting a little bit better in that department. Obviously you have your like groups, so you'll start your like Texas LADC group or Minnesota's therapist group.
I'm a part of so many groups, and maybe other people had different experiences, but I've never like had profound connections at all, or even good conversations from Facebook. There's something about LinkedIn, the way they've designed their platform. Yeah. And maybe it's just more of a mindset. So I don't know. Okay. I'm a LinkedIn cheerleader all the way. Woohoo!
All right. So moving on, So it's not necessarily a law, but would you care to tell us about 988? What is that?
988, yeah, it is the new mental health crisis number. So instead of 911, which people were directed to call before and police would respond, which is not usually the best case scenario, they finally have come together to provide this easy three-digit number instead of, like a 1-800 number that's super hard to memorize at any time, especially when you're in a mental health crisis. So you can call that. It's not only a suicidal crisis line, it's also any other type of mental health crisis. So let's say like you're having a panic attack and you're really scared and you don't know what to do, call 988. When in doubt, call 988. They're not going to say like, you probably shouldn't have called. Like maybe like, hey, I'm having a really stressful day at work. Probably don't call 988. Like talk to a friend instead. But if you're like in over your head, scared, don't know what to do, call 988, please.
And then I guess when that person calls, they'll meet with a therapist. And again, the therapist will try to, I guess, provide a different type of crisis intervention to that client.
Yeah. I mean, they'll speak with an intake worker. I don't know if they're all like credentialed therapists, but they're definitely trained for crisis phone work. But they will, from my understanding, these people are kind of like triaging, right? So depending on what level the client, the caller is at, they'll refer them to appropriate resources in the area.
I know for my company, the minimum you need, which is like my credentials, is a master's degree in some type of therapy field, like social work, mental health, LMFT, etc. Yeah, it's really interesting. Just me personally, I'm trying, like, yeah, last weekend was my first weekend. So now I'm, again, maybe you can help me out with this, but I'm kind of learning the style. Like, okay, a client comes in with a crisis. What are your main goals to do in that situation? Well, calm the client down without telling them to calm down. And
Yeah, don't ever say
then, yeah, just
that.
get figure out like what their issues are, what are their short-term goals? Because in crisis, you're not really thinking about 3 or 4 weeks from now, you're thinking about the next 5 to 10 minutes. And
Exactly.
yeah, collaborating and getting them the best services they need in that moment.
Yeah, definitely. Just like really, you're just like assessing for safety is the most important thing. Like, is this person safe? Are they in danger of hurting themselves or others? That's always forefront. So once you kind of like triage that, you can know like where to go from. Because it might require, like really immediate intervention to keep that person alive.
Yeah, and also determining if they need 911 services or if they can use that service themselves, or are you going to need to call for them?
Right. Yeah. So sometimes it takes that, and maybe they're not willing to make that call, but we are obliged as, professionals that we have to report. We're
Absolutely.
mandated reporters. Yeah.
Well, again, it's been awesome having you on the show and everything. And this is why I like to ask everyone too, like down the road, like what are your future goals like right now? What do you hope to accomplish and achieve further down the road?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, I'm kind of at a segue right now because I'm actually like transitioning, out of mental health, but still like want to dabble in it and see what kind of impact I can have there. The thought that keeps on coming to my mind, because I'm very like entrepreneurial minded, I've been thinking about creating something like a one-stop shop for clinicians. So like having some kind of platform that would provide like support groups, access to clinicians that actually know how to work with other therapists, because not everyone does. I've been to a therapist that she was like literally like intimidated that I had like the same degree as her. And I'm like, no, please tell me, like, yes, I know it in my head, but like I can't see my own blind spots. And she would just say everything like, oh, you already know this. Oh, but you already know this. Like, no, I don't. Like, I know it for other people, but I don't know it for myself. So I think it takes a special kind of training to be a therapist for therapists. And then I would, maybe it would be like a consultancy to where they train management on how to deal with mental health for their mental health professionals. Because in my experience, all of my managers have always been licensed social workers or counselors, which is great, and yet they're not trained in how to deal with employee mental health. And so I think training leadership on how to handle and assess clinicians' needs, and maybe this might be a little bit controversial, but like regular, even mandatory check-ins and assessments with people. And I know this maybe wouldn't go over well, like forcing a therapist to like do an assessment, but I think sometimes we don't know just the impact that our work is having on us. This happened to me, to where I didn't know how much like vicarious trauma I was processing. And it ended up in a very scary situation where I was in a mental health crisis myself, and I had to quit my job very unexpectedly. And so I was just kind of retracing my steps and realized that there were some there were some points where my management could have intervened and maybe prevented things.
Can I ask you something?
Yeah.
For the future managers out there right now, could you give them advice on what are certain signs you may see in a mental health worker that would need some help, like little signs that they're kind of getting burned out, let's say?
Yeah, I think this is a tricky one, because the feedback I got was, oh, you always look so put together. So it's like, oh, that's coming from a therapist. Like, you know, like people, like the persona that you're presenting to the world is not usually, you know, an indicator of what's going on inside. So that's hard. But I would say, for example, like if an employee comes to you and shares something that's going on with them in their life that might impact their work, like I had an aunt die by suicide while I was working in a suicide prevention program. And I told my management, because I wanted them to be aware to know that, like, hey, if you notice a difference in me, will you please like help me? But I didn't know how to word it. And so what happened is they did nothing. They did not check in with me.
Oh.
And there was no, I mean, there could have been a conversation that could have been had there. Like, look, absolutely, we realized like, there's no way to like escape talking about suicide, because literally you're working in a suicide prevention program. But if you're here are some signs to look for, right? So if I had been educated, even though I'm a therapist, like I don't know how to help myself. That's why we all need help outside of ourselves, right?
Absolutely.
And so some kind of training on literally training therapists how to recognize the very signs that you're talking about, because the signs were there. So I would say like somatic issues. So I was having severe migraines. I was having stomach issues. I was having problems sleeping, but I was in denial that it was because of my work. I was in denial because I loved this job so much.
Yes.
But I made my migraines very well known. I said, man, I've never experienced these before. And all of a sudden I have this job and now I'm experiencing them like almost every week. You know, this is like really impacting me. And that could have been an intervention for them. But again, we're trained to advocate for our clients and not for each other. And so I think just the training needs to come on in that manner. It's leadership's responsibility and it's our responsibility. Like, of course we have personal accountability, but sometimes we're in it so deep. Like I was, I didn't even know. I didn't even know what I was going through. And I, you know, my answer to dealing with a lot of things I was going through was to throw myself even deeper into my work. Oh. Like I literally had that like conversation in my head, like, all right, you're going through a lot, like just really commit to your job and maybe things will get better. Mm-hmm. And that was a clear red flag, you know?
And you were in reality, like you said, you were asking for help.
Asking for help and I didn't know how, and it didn't really get communicated. And then even when I did, I did come to my leadership and say like, hey, like I'm having a mental health crisis. Like I need to take time off of work. And how it was received was like, it was a planned, like I was taking a planned break for like vacation. An operation or a vacation. And I was asked to find homes, like therapy homes for all my clients. So I had to farm out my entire caseload before I was able to leave. And I was made to meet with all of my clients one last time to be telling them that I was transitioning them to a new therapist, all while I was having a mental health crisis. Oh. But I didn't know how to spell it out for my management. I didn't know how to say like, look, this is not a planned vacation for me. I am in a crisis. I cannot work another day. But because I've been just like sucking it up for so long, I hammered out for another week and I did everything they asked me to do. I farmed out all my caseload. And then after that, I just broke down and I was like in serious, like, mental health crisis and seeing my own psychiatrist and therapist for a long time.
I got so many like thoughts in my head right now. I mean, initially, I want to ask you, like, when this was first starting, were you again worried about their initial response? What would it be like asking for help due to a crisis? And now I'm fucking thinking, are your managers fucking robots? Are they literally robots with no heart, no human emotions? Again, I'm a little upset right now, but I'll try to.
Yeah, that makes sense. Right, and I appreciate that. And the weird thing is that, like, this is literally like the best leadership I've ever had. My direct supervisor was very caring, very invested in my learning and growing as a professional. But this was an area where I felt very betrayed and that my profession had failed me. And it hurt. It hurt me to my core because I had poured my blood, sweat, and tears into this program for 2 years. It wasn't like I was a new employee. They knew me. They knew me for 2 years. Mm-hmm. And I tried not to take it personally. And that's why I'm like, okay, I'm trying to separate it. Like, she just didn't have, even though she was an LPC, she didn't have the training on how to help employees with their mental health. It's no excuse for what happened.
Is it training or is it being a damn human being with decent love?
I know. See, this is like, a part of being like,
there's people across the street that would have empathy for you working at a damn coffee shop. You know, okay, like, again, I'll try to calm down and give them some empathy. Maybe I could say they're extremely overworked and they don't have time. But I don't know. It doesn't make sense to me. And
it doesn't. It doesn't. And I tried to wrap my mind around it for so long and it's still lingering and I still don't, it's two and a half years later. Like, that was in January of 2020. Oh my gosh, it's almost been like 3 years. And I still don't really know how to make sense of that process. No therapist has been able to like help me. I've just kind of like been very much on my own in this process. Not to mention, like, when you quit a job, you lose all your benefits. So yeah. When I quit, I had no longer had access to mental health services. So I was paying out of pocket, which only lasted for so long. And then I've been without for the past, mm-hmm. you know, year and a half, 2 years, I've just been without services and I've just been trying to figure it out. And it's like, yeah. Again, a part of the system has failed me. The system has failed me. I gave my life for 10 years and when I needed it the most, like, my profession wasn't there for me and it sucks.
In your shoes, it's like, who am I to you? You know, just the way you again robotically speak to me, I don't think I'm much of anything to you as a number maybe. And again, the reason I'm feeling so emotional is I haven't been through your experience in entirety, but I've been through similar things that you have been through. Not only at my jobs, but even grad school, from the professors, similar things. And it's so disheartening how evil, in a sense, we are to each other in this field, how we don't take care of each other. It's like, what are we portraying to future therapists out there?
Yeah, there's a lot of work that needs to be done. And I mean, yeah, I try to come up with solutions and that's the thing I can think of is like putting together some kind of platform to train managers of clinicians to do better because at the end of the day, like it's going to be better for business. They lost a very good employee.
Amen.
Like I'm like not trying to brag, but I was damn good at my job and I poured my whole soul into it and they lost out big time.
Absolutely.
And so did I, you know, it affected me, my life for years to come, you know, so I was so traumatized. I've literally had to completely leave the field. And so I think while I see the meaning and the purpose in it, I think that there's a lot we can do to prevent this. And this is more than burnout. Like, I hate the word burnout. I'm not talking about burnout here. I'm talking about something much more sinister.
You would, again, like I said, in my prior episode, we get into this too, where there's a fine line of like burnout self-care where I use the example of 50 clients where this person never had 50, but was again, hypothetical, but like self-care doesn't do anything. If you have 40, 50 clients, like that can't help. Like no self-care can help you. There needs to be something bigger that needs to change.
Yeah. And yet you know, I don't know about in your master's program, but that was like literally shoved down our throat. Self-care, self-care, self-care,
yep.
Compassion, yep. Fatigue, compassion, fatigue. Like maybe if we just talk about it, it will go away is like the mentality. And it's like, come on, people. Uh-huh. Like, yes, talking about it's important, but like more than talking is like the doing. What is behind it? Like, what is causing this burnout? And kind of the attitude I got from my grad program and really the profession in general was like, well, we're going to work for nonprofits and you're probably not going to get paid well, and it's probably going to suck. You're going to have a high caseload, but be sure to take a lot of bubble baths.
And again, you're not in it for the money. And I've said this numerous of my episodes, that pisses me off more than anything, especially when other counselors tell me, oh, we're not in it for the money. Why the hell not? Why can't we make, again, a good salary, good benefits, and help people at the same time, so we're happy and feel taken care of so we can take care of other people?
Yeah.
It's God, not that grinds really my gears more.
I think that's the thing that we've been, it's a myth that we've bought into is like, yes, you can only help people while hurting yourself.
Yes.
Financially and emotionally. And it's just not true, people. Don't buy into it.
Mm-hmm.
Don't buy into it. And that's what I'm talking about is like, people need to start speaking up.
Yes.
And this is how we affect change. We teach people how we are going to tolerate being treated. And I will be the first to admit, I accepted low paying jobs. Working with kids, those are the lowest paying jobs you could find. So I accepted it. I taught employers what was okay, that it was okay to pay me $20 an hour for a master's degree and almost a decade worth of experience. By accepting that, I was communicating, this is okay with me. I will accept this.
And again, hindering your boundaries. So, and again, like in grad school, that's what they would tell us, is just like set boundaries, really focus on self-care and set boundaries. Okay. So let's say you have like a certain amount of clients you're okay with and your boss wants to give you like two more. All right. Set boundaries, but then now you got to worry about what your boss is going to think of you down the road. Like, oh, this person's not willing to help out the team, or he can't,
yeah,
he can't have any extra work. I mean, these are real life things.
They are. And you know what? At the hospital I worked at, it's a nonprofit, and the fully licensed therapist, because I was working on getting my clinical license, so I wasn't held to the same standards as the fully licensed therapist. But the fully licensed therapists were held to key performance indicators or KPIs. So they had to see X number of clients, X number of hours,
mm-hmm,
at a nonprofit. So this is like not only affecting business, like the business side of mental health, like this has also creeped into the nonprofit world, is we're holding, mm-hmm, clinicians to the standard of quote unquote productivity. And I would see my coworkers, how stressed they were eating lunch at their desks. They were just frantically going from one session to the other while I was taking a break. I went downstairs and ate my lunch. I went outside and took a walk,
mm-hmm,
you know, like I was able to do these things that at the end of the day still didn't help, because, you know, I was, you know, the nature of the work was too hard. It couldn't compensate for it. But then I was wondering, like, my poor coworkers, they're being held to a standard and getting hammered by leadership on why they're not meeting their productivity levels.
Exactly.
It was just nuts. And I saw this, I was just like an outsider, like looking in, and I didn't really fully understand what was going on at the time. But now I understand, like, oh my gosh, mm-hmm, like just how crazy that was, that was happening like in a nonprofit, that they're being pushed to bring in revenue.
Yep. Yeah.
And I get it. Like, it's a bit, at the end of the day, it's a business. You got to turn the lights on. You got to pay the employees.
Mm-hmm.
But my answer is that there's a more sustainable way that's going to be good for your employees and good for business. And that's what this like one-stop shop consultancy thing that I'm proposing would address. You know, and I don't know if I'll start it, but like, I'm good with coming up with ideas. And so maybe someone will take that idea and run with it. Maybe it's already happening on some levels, but like, we just got to do better. We got to do better for each other. And we got to teach people, you know, how to treat us and what we're willing to accept and not accept.
And that, again, goes with combining, getting together with other therapists and being unified in some way to, yes, take that stand.
You know? Absolutely. Unity is the key, you know, it really is. My main message is just like, you know, standing up for ourselves as professionals, advocating to have better training for our leadership. You know, they work for us. our managers work for us, right? They don't have clients that they're seeing. Their job is to take care of us. And I'm not saying that they need to become our therapists, but they do need to become more trained in how to recognize burnout, compassion fatigue, and, you know, clinical, like a stress response, a vicarious trauma. Like, I feel like there's not like a full term that encapsulates what I'm trying to get at, but like, yeah, it's more than burnout. It's more like, oh man, I'm just tired. It's way more than that.
Oh, I agree. I really do. Well, again, Kristen, it has been such a pleasure and honor having you on the show. We learned so much from you. You said a lot of amazing things. And if any of my listeners actually want to get a hold of you, is there a particular way they could do that through like email or a LinkedIn account or whatnot?
Yeah. LinkedIn is the best way to get a hold of me. So it's just Kristen Terry LMSW. I mean, you could just do a search for me and it should pop right up. But if you have any like show notes or anything, you're welcome to like put the link to my profile in there, and folks can message me with that. That way I love connecting with other mental health professionals and having these conversations. And if you're at the point to where you think that you are ready to transition careers, I'm happy to talk to you too and share my journey there.
That's awesome. And yes, I'll put all that in the show notes.
Cool. Thanks so much, Jacob. This was fun.
It was a blast. Thank you. I just want to, again, thank Kristen for another amazing BHI episode. I also want to thank all of my supportive listeners. And I want to express that the content informed in this episode was not meant to be taken as therapeutic advice. If you do find yourself struggling with any type of mental health or addiction issues, please seek the care of a licensed medical doctor as well as a licensed mental health therapist. All right, everyone, thank you and have a great day. Bye.